From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, investigative reporter Lester Graham, ready to blow the whistle on this season's political ads.
The fact is, a lot of people get their political news from the political ads.
And how about new businesses in Detroit? We're not talking cars or Shinola. How about a vegan Coney Island?
I'll try it once. You know, I'll give it a chance.
Then from morning in America to criminal three strikes laws, we use analogies every day. Not that we pay that much attention to them.
And that's because they're so central to our thinking that we don't even recognize that they're there.
We will have those stories and much, much more today on Stateside. One political ad every 2 minutes. That happened in the second week of September, if you were watching TV here in Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty, today on Stateside, the good, the bad, and the ugly of election 2014 political ads.
Rick Snyder says he makes tough choices, like cutting over $1 billion from education. That's tough on kids.
And then Michigan Radio's sports commentator John U. Bacon is here.
Well, on the field, it's not been much fun for the Wolverines, of course.
It's been sad trumpet sounds, wah, 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 for U of M lately. We will find out why later in the show. But first, 18 months is how long emergency managers are allowed to stay in power under the state's emergency manager law. And it has now been 18 months that Kevin Orr has been in charge of Detroit's finances. There have been closed-door meetings between Mayor Mike Duggan and Detroit City Council members this week talking about Orr's future. Here to fill us in is Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick and Nancy Kaffer, columnist at the Detroit Free Press. Hey, you two.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So first, Sarah, fill us in on what we know about these ongoing conversations in council.
Well, in terms of substantive details of these conversations, we really don't know a whole lot at all. They started after the council's, they formally started after the council's weekly session on Tuesday. And as far as we know, they've carried on ever since, mostly involving Mayor Duggan and the council members, but also at various points, Kevin Orr himself and some of the federal mediators who have been involved in Detroit's bankruptcy process. Leading up to this, I mean, we knew that they were trying to work out a transition agreement to transition Orr out as the emergency manager. The date for that, in which that could actually happen at the earliest, is Saturday, I believe. But in terms of what that process is going to look like and what's been agreed on so far, we really don't know.
Nancy, what are you hearing?
You know, this is a politically difficult situation because if you were elected during the tenure of the emergency manager as a Detroit official, it's a really fine line for you to walk. There's a necessity of what's happening in the bankruptcy. And frankly, if Kevin Orr were to leave amidst this bankruptcy, I can't help but think it disaster is kind of a mild term for how it would play out. But that puts, you can't blame politicians for taking political considerations into account. And it's a very strange spot to be in, to be either considering whether or not to keep the emergency manager who, in the eyes of some voters, has supplanted the Democratic rule in the city, in an awful way, keeping this person for the pragmatism of running the bankruptcy, but then sort of the point of the way many people are going to view this.
Here's State Senator Burt Johnson, a Democrat. He opposed an EM initially, but this is what he said yesterday.
It's a little bit of a precarious situation we find ourselves in right now. I don't know that the city of Detroit hasn't been taken too far down this road of bankruptcy, where it can let probably its chief bankruptcy specialist go in the middle of that fight.
Okay, so Burt Johnson, Democrat, one lawmaker initially against the EM, now saying, hey, we need Orr around in some capacity. So, Sarah, what does it sound like Orr will be doing for the city if and when he's voted out as EM?
First of all, I think Nancy's absolutely right in the fact that we really can't overlook the political dimensions of all this, or you're sort of balancing what is allowed under Public Act 436, the mm-hmm. Emergency Manager Law, and also what these politicians have all, elected leaders in Detroit have all campaigned on, and what they all may or may not want at this point, or even, you know, regardless of what maybe they want, what they sort of in their practical heart of hearts know that they can get or need to finish out this bankruptcy process. I think that Duggan has, you know, when he was campaigning, quite understandably, he was very much against, you know, the concept of an emergency manager and, you know, Kevin Orr as the emergency manager. But he's sort of softened the rhetoric quite a bit recently and even gone so far as to say things like, well, you know, if Kevin Orr, if, you know, I'm against having him as an emergency manager, but, you know, if he hadn't been emergency manager, I would have hired him as a bankruptcy lawyer to advise me on this process. And I need him on as a consultant type arrangement to finish out this bankruptcy. So I think that's what is the arrangement that they're trying to make. I think the devil is really in the details, though, in terms of, you know, what powers are going to be transitioned back to fully to the mayor and to the council.
Another point that something that Judge Rhodes, who's overseeing the city's bankruptcy, and the person who he hired to evaluate the city's plan of adjustment and its feasibility after bankruptcy, they have both emphasized that the city's ability to get its business together and to run itself with agreement between the branches of government, moving forward in a unified fashion to actually execute this plan is the real make or break factor to whether or not the plan is viable. So if we kind of, the end of the bankruptcy has begun, and if we can't make it through the end of the bankruptcy without infighting and poor decisions about managing the bankruptcy being made, I don't know how anyone has confidence about the management of the city post-bankruptcy.
Right, and Governor Snyder has been saying the same thing as well. The governor, of course, who appointed emergency manager Kevin Orr, here's what he also had to say yesterday.
I think there's a lot of potential value to say how he could stay involved in some capacity with respect to the bankruptcy proceedings themselves.
So it sounds like everyone is on the same page, whether we agreed with the fact that an EM should be appointed or not. Everyone now thinks he should stick around. But again, I think, as you're saying, we just don't know what that's going to look like.
Well, and here's another point. Technically, the term of the emergency manager really can't end until the emergency has been resolved. If you are still in bankruptcy, can you legitimately claim that the emergency is over?
Just because 18 months is up.
Right. I mean, you know, and then there's all these questions about whether or not, and when PA 436 was passed, I think that there were differing opinions on whether or not the 18-month term meant for a specific emergency manager or for an emergency manager generally. So can Governor Snyder appoint a different emergency manager when Kevin Orr's term is up? Does that mean that you only get 18 months of emergency management ever? I mean, these are questions that, if pushed, will lead to litigation, and I don't see how litigation is going to really convey the impression that people are on the same page and are moving in lockstep for the benefit of the city.
We're talking with Nancy Kaffer, columnist at the Detroit Free Press, and Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter. Sarah and Nancy, both of you, of course, cover the city. What is the sense now, 18 months on? Did things work out as folks sort of assumed they would? Have things been better than sort of all of the scary headlines that were written when, you know, bankruptcy was first filed, when Kevin Orr first took over?
I would say that I think things have been better in the sense that, you know, people were saying initially that this bankruptcy case could take years, it could be dragged out, it could be bogged down in this sort of legal no man's land forever. That certainly doesn't appear to have happened, and I think everyone's expectation is that the actual bankruptcy process itself is going to be resolved pretty quickly within the next few weeks here. But I think, you know, sort of the real proof in the pudding in terms of how the bankruptcy process is really going to affect Detroit and whether, you know, and then this transition back to the, you know, actual governance of the elected leaders. I mean, it's important to note that the state is going to stay pretty heavily involved in Detroit's finances for the next probably several years or so, you know, and they can under the emergency manager law. So Detroit is once again going to be sort of entering this hybrid phase where the elected leaders and the state are sort of going to be, I think, haggling a little bit more over specific powers. And I think we've already started to see some instances in which, you know, the state and the emergency manager want one thing and maybe the city council wants another thing. So I think there's going to be this kind of ongoing struggle over the balance of power and how it's going to resolve itself. I don't know yet.
Nancy, do you see that happening as well?
You know, there's always a push-pull in politics as to who holds what power. I mean, city council and mayor have a duty, a city charter granted duty, to exercise their abilities on behalf of the city's best interest. For council, there's a fiduciary responsibility to ensure that things that they're passing, that the mayor is proposing, are good for the mayor, obviously administrative and executive responsibilities. Because there is a state board in place, that's going to be a part of the transition doesn't excuse them from those responsibilities. And it would be, I think, you know, if the mayor and council just kind of stood by and let a state board run everything, I don't think they would be doing their jobs. As Sarah said about something else, the devil is in the details, as generally it is, and how that relationship works, how those relationships are managed, and what kind of sensitivity and openness both sides bring to these negotiations. Everyone has to keep in mind the city has to come first, the residents have to come first. It's the whole point of the bankruptcy. It's the whole point of having a city is to serve residents. And, you know, the big changes that the bankruptcy could potentially have are incremental. These are not things where suddenly you wake up one day and all of your streetlights are on or all of the abandoned houses are down, or, you know, these are slow changes that happen over time. And if these things happen, people will have confidence in the system. And if they don't happen, then what are we doing any of this for?
Finally, in the last minute that we have, quickly to both of you, what are you going to be watching for, let's say, in the next few days?
The outcome of this particular conversation with the form of Kevin Orr's, what really needs to be continued relationship with the city and its bankruptcy is, and how various, the kind of public front the mayor, the council, and Orr present here. We need to see unity.
I agree. I think how there, because clearly there are negotiations and probably pretty spirited conversations going on behind the scenes, but I'll be pretty interested to see in terms of the deal that does eventually emerge, how much people, you know, they obviously want to present a united front. I'll be interested to see how much that actually materializes, and if it does, how long it will last.
Mm-hmm. Detroit reporter Sarah Swick for Michigan Radio and Nancy Kaffer, columnist at the Detroit Free Press. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Zoe.
Thank you, Zoe.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark. We use analogies every day, and yet we rarely even think about them, right? That they're just sort of part of our vocabulary, our speech, our lexicon. But for John Pollock, analogies are not something to be ignored. Pollock is the author of the new book, Shortcut: How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas. Hi, John.
Hi.
So I have to say, when reading this book, one sort of has this huge aha moment where, you know, we all use analogies, but I don't think many of us realize how influential they are in everyday life.
Well, you're right. And that's because they're so central to our thinking that we don't even recognize that they're there, but they often have big consequences on how we view the world. As I say, there are a lot of analogies that ring true that actually turn out not to be true. For example, the domino theory. A reporter in 1954 asked President Eisenhower, "What's the strategic significance of French Indochina?" And he said, "Well, set up a row of dominoes and tip the first one over, and the next one goes, and the next one goes, and sure enough, the last one will tip over. If we don't stop the communists in Vietnam, there goes Cambodia, Laos, Malaysia, Thailand, and pretty soon they're knocking at our door." And that analogy translated something that was complex and far away into everyday language that ordinary Americans could understand. And while it wasn't solely responsible for the escalation, it certainly framed America's thinking about Vietnam and sold the country on the dangers. And we lost thousands and thousands and thousands of soldiers. There were many more Vietnamese killed. It cost billions of dollars. And we lost. And then, of course, the analogy proved to be completely false because the neighboring countries didn't topple like dominoes. And the reason is that countries have different cultures, politics, leaders, geography, and dominoes are little square tabletop blocks. That mistake was very costly.
John, one of the things that I found most fascinating was the idea of inventions. Everything from the printing press, the Wright brothers, Ford, and the moving assembly, you take us back to the fact that a lot of these things happen because of analogies.
You're absolutely right. Analogies, while they can be misleading sometimes, can also be extraordinarily revealing in new and powerful ways. And we see that through the history of invention. Let's take a recent example, a relatively recent example, and that is when Steve Jobs and Apple introduced the Mac in 1984. Until that time, computers had been very difficult and unfriendly. And as a consequence, you had to be a techie to use them. And when he took the desktop analogy, he translated not just through technology, but in terms of explaining the new technology, how everyday people could use a computer by taking something that was horizontal, a physical desktop, and making it vertical and digital with an icon for a file folder, with an icon for a trash can. People suddenly said, well, I can use a desktop, so I can use a Mac. And then, of course, that was copied by other manufacturers and software makers. And now billions of people can use a computer. And it was that desktop analogy that really made it possible and persuaded people that they could exploit the power of a computer.
In the book, Shortcut, you kind of give us five ways or five different things that make a good analogy. Help us understand what makes for a good analogy.
Well, there are three that are most important that I think that people can apply to their thinking that will help them the most. One is all analogies highlight some things and hide other things. And so we need to question the analogies that we hear. When someone makes an analogy, they're making an argument. They're asserting certain things, making the case for similarities. We need to ask, well, what about this analogy doesn't work? Now, it might be that on careful examination, the analogy is just fine, and it works, and there are no downsides. But it might be that your comparison reveals flaws and disqualifying flaws. So that's one, question the analogies you hear. Second, effective analogies play on our emotions. For example, in the Iowa Senate race that's going on right now, the Republican candidate ran an ad that said, I grew up on a hog farm castrating pigs. Send me to Washington, I'll cut pork. And it's a tremendously appealing, funny ad that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you like her or you don't like her, it's a great and appealing analogy. It happens to be wrong because the skill set of hog castration are completely different than the skill set of negotiating and finding compromise in the Senate.
One would assume.
Let's hope so. There's mud flying in both. So, but this illustrates how appealing that analogy is because it plays on our emotions, our frustration with Washington, our low opinion of many elected officials, not all of them, because there are great elected officials trying to do good work, but the general reputation of Washington is somewhat well-earned these days. So the third thing is that people should explore multiple analogies because there's always more than one that will fit any given situation. And analogies are models, and before you marry one model, you should date some others.
Some of the biggest speeches and political parts of history, you bring up analogies in them. FDR and his fireside chats, full of analogies. MLK's I Have a Dream speech, full of analogies. Reagan, Morning in America. Why are analogies so present in politics?
Well, politics presents an interesting challenge because running a country or solving some of the toughest issues that we confront as a country, it's a challenge, and there are no easy solutions. Or if there were easy solutions, we'd have solved all these problems by now. But people's attention spans are short. People don't have time to go into these issues in depth. And so leaders and candidates often use analogies to distill something complicated into something simpler to understand. Just like the Senate candidate in Iowa, again, talks about hog castration and cutting pork. Pork is an analogy. So throughout history, we see some great examples. you mentioned FDR and the fireside chats. Well, before the United States entered World War II, Great Britain was under attack from the Nazis, and there was a lot of debate in the United States, should we help them by providing war material? And, of course, President Roosevelt was very strongly in favor of supporting them, and there were isolationists in Congress that said, we have no interest in this war, we want no part of it, mm-hmm. let's stay out. And at a press conference, Roosevelt grew frustrated and he said, look it, if your neighbor's house is on fire and you have a garden hose, you're not going to say, hey, pay me $15 for my garden hose. You're going to lend the hose, hook it up to the hydrant, put out the fire, and if the hose gets damaged, then you'll talk about it later and be compensated later. And that garden hose analogy, as it came to be known, really swayed public opinion, and the United States was able to implement and pass through Congress the Lend-Lease program that provided a lot of crucial support to Great Britain at a critical time until the United States, of course, entered the war after Pearl Harbor.
John, as you write in the book, analogies are not always perfect, and you write about the danger that they can pose. You know, making certain political statements too easy to understand, for example, you write about the three strikes law in California or balancing the federal budget like a household budget.
Right. Let's talk about the federal budget and the household budget analogy, because it's a completely false analogy. Now, one can see the appeal of the analogy because we all live in households and we can't spend more than we take in for very long or we get into big trouble. And you hear leaders on the right saying, you know, this is like a household budget. We need to cut government. Well, there's some big differences between a household budget and a government budget. First of all, the needs of the United States of America are perpetual. That is, they go on in perpetuity, year after year, decade after decade, century after century, and they require big investments. If we had never made the Louisiana Purchase, which was a huge amount of debt, if we had never invested in the interstate highway system, for example, we wouldn't be the nation we are today. And so the debt of the United States of America has been in debt since its founding for every year but one during the Jackson administration, and that debt has generally speaking, served the United States well because it's allowed us to finance great leaps forward. The second thing is that as a household, you can either cut your expenses or work more hours and try and bring in more money. But the United States of America has, you know, big tools that it can use. We can influence the inflation rate and bring down the cost of money for our debt. We can print more money. We can issue debt. And so that analogy breaks down very quickly, both in terms of the goals of the country, the needs of the country, and the means at its disposal. But again, the analogy is appealing, and that's why it's important for people to think critically about these analogies and not bite a hook and suddenly find yourself dangling on a line.
The other example that you give is the three strikes law in California, which I think sounds very reasonable to some folks. Three strikes, that's what you get in baseball.
Right, and the three strikes ballot initiative, which sent third-time offenders to prison for 25 years to life, came out of a genuine revulsion against repeat criminals in the 1990s and a desire to get tough on crime and a completely legitimate need of society. And that law was from California, became a model for three strikes laws in about half the states. The problem with three strikes laws is that the third offense in many cases turned out to be someone stealing a slice of pizza or breaking into a car to take change from a cup holder. And that, of course, fills up prisons with nonviolent offenders that cost $50,000 apiece every year. And so our annual prison tab is something in the neighborhood of $75 billion. And we've got over 2 million prisoners. And so three strikes laws are very costly, and you need to ask, well, why are we modeling our penal policy on baseball? What do the two have in common? Again, here's where the emotions come into play. we think of baseball as being fair. It has rules. They're very clear rules. And when an umpire makes a decision, that decision is final. The other thing about baseball is that it's very statistically driven. There are stats for everything in baseball, and there's a great sense of personal accountability to the game. And so when you frame the challenge of prison and sentencing policy in terms of baseball, that emotion transfers over, and it becomes a very persuasive selling tool, and the analogy leads us astray.
Right. You know, writers Keith Holyoke and Paul Thagard, who write analogies should enhance thinking, not substitute for it.
That's exactly right. And so we need to be critical thinkers about the analogies that we encounter.
Talking about the three strikes law in California and then election 2014 heating up, and it feels like we hear a lot about battling and campaigns. Why is it that in present day, sports and war analogies seem to be used the most?
Well, we've got a lot of sports and we've got a lot of war, so there's a lot of material to work with. Second is, we use certain analogies to import emotion from one situation to another. And in the case of sports, we're trying to up the ante by making war analogies. In a war, you might be trying to calm people down yet motivate them as they go into battle. And so you frame things in terms of sports and teamwork and victory. And so there are close relationships between the two, but of course they're very different because in sports you've got very specific rules and a growing consciousness of violence and the costs of violence and the limits on violence. And in war, it seems increasingly anything goes. And they're very different, but there's a lot of, as you noted, crossover between the language. You know, it's interesting. If you look at football today and you go to games, there's been an increase in the militarization of football. Mm. You have more flyovers. You have more flags. There is a deep association between war and football. Even the language of football, you know, the linemen are in the trenches. You have the blitz. You're throwing the bomb. It becomes a self-reinforcing cycle of language. The nuclear codes that are manacled to a military aide of the president, that's colloquially known as the football. And I think that in a sense, these become cliches that people rely on. We hear so many sports cliches in business. Well, don't drop the ball, keep your eye on the ball. And while sometimes these analogies can be useful, cliches are desiccated analogies, and they lose their effectiveness over time as people forget the original meaning. And the most effective leaders are those who can come up with fresh analogies.
And when it comes to war and campaigns, it seems like particularly right now, you can't read a newspaper, you can't turn on the TV without hearing about election 2014 and candidates and the war of words, or duking it out, or battling campaigns.
Yeah, or even campaigns themselves. There were military campaigns before there were political campaigns, because the wars predate democracy.
Finally, John, I just have to ask, do you have a favorite analogy?
Well, I like the analogy that is perfect in its own moment, that brings clarity to a situation. I think that the best analogies are often ephemeral, but serve their purpose, and then we move on. So I'd hate to show favoritism to any particular analogy.
Fair enough. John Pollack, former White House speechwriter and author of the new book Shortcut: How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas. John, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on, Zoe.
A recent report says in Michigan, you will see one political ad every 2 minutes on television. That is crazy talk. I am Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty, and with us right now is Lester Graham. Hey, Lester.
Hi there.
So as part of a Truth Squad, which is this really cool thing that Bridge Magazine is doing, looking at how truthful political ads are this election cycle, you've been working with them on that. Tell me one of the misconceptions about political ads.
Well, it reminds me of this story. I was actually in a barbershop at one point, and I'm kind of listening in on the conversation with the other barber, and this person says, you know, I'm so sick and tired of those political ads. They're just terrible. And those politicians are all so horrible. I mean, they must be, because they can't lie on those ads or they couldn't be on TV. And the fact is, the FCC has rules in place that actually tells broadcasters you may not challenge or change a federal candidate's political ad. They could say any darn thing they want to, and it doesn't matter if they even closely or even a little bit resembles the truth.
And we know one of these crazy things that happen too, which campaigns will do, is they will spend so much time figuring out the exact right words to use in those ads, right? So you can't really call them out necessarily, or it's kind of fuzzy math.
Yeah, it's the context means a lot, and a lot of times the context is left out because why explain it? We can say this and it'll seem just perfectly rational to somebody who doesn't pay attention to what's going on. The fact is, a lot of people get their political news from the political ads. I know that sounds horrible to a lot of, you know, conscientious voters out there, but that's the fact.
And people will say, oh, ads don't persuade me. I don't pay attention to them.
Yeah, I beg to differ. I've talked to too many experts that say they actually do, especially negative ads. Negative ads have a greater impact on us than the positive glow and fuzzy ones.
Right, and if campaigns didn't believe that, they wouldn't be spending the millions and millions and millions of dollars that they do, right?
Exactly. And, you know, in the end, as long as you have big givers, big donors pumping in that money, they're going to continue to do that. But, you know, we've been looking at these ads, and the Truth Squad guys have come up with a good system of rules, a no foul, a warning, a regular foul, and a flagrant foul. And there have been a fair number of flagrant fouls and fouls this year, as you might expect. I didn't really want to pick out just two, but I think the outside groups that are putting on ads on behalf of candidates, or maybe not on their behalf, but without coordination of the candidate, let's put it that way. And the Democratic Governors Association recently put up one that was attacking Rick Snyder. And basically, they were trying to say that Snyder helps out business at the expense of ordinary taxpayers.
Rick Snyder says he makes tough choices, like cutting over $1 billion from education. That's tough on kids.
Now, why the ad got a foul call from the Truth Squad is that it kind of didn't go into all the details that, yes, Rick Snyder did cut $1 billion from schools, but in subsequent years, he and the legislature added money back in. A lot of that money is going to shore up the underfunded pension, the teachers' pension funds, not so much in the classroom. The average classroom per student amount is basically the same. But you can see how they could say that, but it wouldn't be quite true, even though it is kind of true.
Right,
so it gets a foul.
And look, there's the deep voice. There's the music.
I know it's all authority, isn't it? And it's serious stuff.
No. So I must pay attention, and it must be truthful because they are so serious.
Now, the Republican Governors Association ran an ad, too, and it got a flagrant foul.
Ooh.
And here's where that came in.
Mark Schauer is a politician who has made wrong, expensive choices. Some defy reason. In the state legislature, Schauer supported a new fee on nursing home beds.
Fees on nursing home beds?
Michigan's coming back without more fees on nursing home beds.
But that nursing home fee did not defy reason. I mean, the Truth Squad says it benefited nursing homes by allowing the state to get additional Medicaid funds to reimburse those nursing homes. So they actually got more money.
Yeah.
And Governor Snyder has supported and extended that exact same fee since then. So what do you call?
Right. And of course, it goes back to this idea that apparently people only have, you know, the attention span of about 8 seconds. And so you just throw out these words and these
narratives. Yeah. And that just sounds terrible.
So, Lester, you've been doing this now for a couple campaign seasons. Are there any takeaways from this year in particular, as opposed to sort of the other cycles? Anything that you're really noticing?
Yeah.
Just the same
it's the same stuff. And it's the same stuff I say every time I get the chance to. don't pay attention to the political ads. Go do a little bit of homework for yourself. I mean, there are lots of media out there covering this stuff in a legitimate way. Some of the TV stations, some of the radio stations, some of the newspapers, they're all doing a pretty decent job. And the Truth Squad is, if you're interested in finding out, you know, was that true? The Truth Squad has covered a lot of those, and they're at bridgemi.com. And you can find a lot of those ads have been reviewed in there.
Lester Graham, Michigan Radio's investigative reporter with Michigan Watch. Lester, thanks for keeping him truthful.
Thanks, Zoe.
Okay, let's talk some sports now. John U. Bacon, Michigan Radio sports commentator, is here. Hey, Bacon.
Hey, Zoster.
So, Brady Hoke, University of Michigan football coach. What is going on?
Well, on the field, it's not been much fun for the Wolverines, of course. They've lost 8 of their last 12, and their 4 wins are over teams like Appalachian State and Miami of Ohio, not Florida, which had an 18-game losing streak going into that game. So, on the field is not much fun. I would say off the field it might be less fun, where the stands are increasingly empty. And, of course, Michigan football this week was embarrassed by one of my former students, Alejandro Zuniga, who tweeted the offer, of course, the famous offer now from Coca-Cola. You can get 2 free tickets to Minnesota game this weekend if you buy 2 Cokes, 2 Sprites, or 2 Diet Cokes, et cetera. Only 2 totals. So.
Right. So they did the math. It was like you could get 2 Coke products, so that'd be about $3. The tickets were each $75. So you were basically paying $3 for $150 worth of tickets.
Which Alejandro did the math, and God bless him for this, 98% discount. That's a good deal.
I'd take it. So what is going on here, John? I mean, what does that tell you?
It tells you that it's not that the team on the field that's in trouble. It's the team off the field that's really in trouble. That keep in mind that, look, Bo went 6-6 in 84. Lloyd Carr and Gary Moore together went 8-4 for 4 straight years. Lloyd Carr went 7-5 in 05. Rich Rodriguez went 3-9, 5-7, 7-6. And 7-6 was his best record. That's Brady Hoke's worst record last year. Through all those seasons, the season tickets sold out in January, and you had a very robust wait list. So it's not just the record. People will confuse this, I think. That the streak of attendance, which goes back since 1975, I believe it's 254 games total now, of 100,000 fans or more for all these games. It has survived recessions, the worst one, of course, in 08-09 when team was not very good. It's not the economy, stupid, as we say. It is not even the team on the field.
Well, and this is what's so crazy is what I'm noticing, at least after games. I mean, yes, people are talking about these big losses, as we've been talking about. But what I'm hearing, which I never remembered hearing, is, okay, well, how many people were there? Do we know how many people were in the stands? I mean, since when did that become part of U of M football, was talk of attendance? I mean, it used to be, we broke the record. We broke the record again. And now what we're hearing is people just talk about how many people were showing up.
And how they calculate this and all the rest. It's a bit of, I think, voodoo math, but who knows. Yeah, that's become a topic du jour, of course. I think it's seen, rightly or wrongly, as a knell for the not just the team, but the program.
Yeah.
That if that streak is broken, then that's a sign that something bigger is broken, which it might be.
And what is that bigger thing, then?
The bigger thing is, right now, the fans' discontent. I always often joke, by the way, that Michigan fans are not happy unless they're not happy. They will find something to complain about. I recall years ago on my sports talk show, which is not the station, of course, that Michigan had beaten Notre Dame 38-0. There was a ranked Notre Dame team. It was a dominant performance. It was an unbelievably good game. And we said as a joke Sunday morning, okay, Michigan fans, what can you possibly complain about? Well, they filled 2 hours.
Of course. Right. Then it wasn't 60-0.
Exactly.
Or the fact that there was that 10-yard run in the second quarter.
And worrying about the backup quarterback. And so that's the normally stand. However, what I'm seeing now, and Lord knows, and I have been one of these, of course, Michigan fans can complain about almost anything. But it must be said, what I'm seeing now is not them being unhappy about being unhappy.
Yeah.
I see them upset that they're not upset. I see them alarmed by their lack of alarm.
Yeah.
What I'm seeing now is something I've not seen before, Zoe, and that is indifference. People shrugging, leaving the stadium, going ho hum. That's where things are now.
And how damaging is that then to the brand?
To borrow the parlance of the day, of course. There you go. I would say very, because look, you know the old hallmark cliche: the opposite of love is not hate; it's indifference. I mean, Michigan fans could get angry. they could get upset. A loss might ruin your week. It's even sadder, I suppose, if I'm running that operation, that they're not upset, that they're accepting this is their lot in life, and they're getting kind of bored.
It's telling.
It is telling. And look, also, the real problem for me is not, as I'm looking at this, is not this week, next week, how the team's doing, what about the streak and so on. It's 5 years out down the road, 10 years down the road. This budget has boomed from about $100 million 4 years ago when the new athletic director, Dave Brandon, took over, to about $150 million now. A 50% increase in revenues and budget is alarming to any division at the University of Michigan, I would say. More so if you just realize that the guys you're selling tickets to don't want them anymore, it seems. Mm-hmm. You can't give these things away, literally. And now if you're a season ticket holder and you paid $3,000 or $4,000 for your four tickets, you're sitting next to a guy who bought two Sprites.
You're feeling like you didn't quite get it.
Michigan fans may be irrational, but they're not stupid. And I think this is not going to go over well with those kind of people. So how can you possibly come back next year with a straight face and say, oh, yeah, for you it's still $4,000? It's not going
to
fly.
So, John, the question is then, what needs to change? Will it change?
Two good questions. The direction's got to change. It's not just where you're going. It's not just where you are. It's where you're going, of course. And 4-8 the last 12 games, the team has got to turn it around. I think they probably will. They're a better team than they're showing so far. Minnesota's not that great, so we'll see what happens.
Well, and just in the last minute we have, as you said, Minnesota, U of M playing for the little brown jug on Saturday. What are you going to be watching for?
Just to see them get their offense going. The offense has not scored a touchdown in their last two games against serious opponents, Notre Dame and Utah. So they got to score some points. Little fun fact for you, Zoe. The little brown jug is neither little nor brown. It was the big pink jug, but no one wants to play for that. I think it was named, by the way, for a song called Little Brown Jug by a guy named Joseph Winter in 1869, which celebrates alcoholism. Go ahead and look it up.
Only you, John Bacon. This is why we bring you on stateside.
Little fun fact for you. There you go.
John U. Bacon, sports commentator for Michigan Radio. Thanks so much.
Zoe, always a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. And now, here are some easy rhymes with bass ways to make money in Detroit. That was the headline without the rhyming in a recent Jalopnik blog by my next guest, Aaron Foley. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Zoe. How are you?
Good. So you came up with this list. What's behind it?
Yeah, you know, I think everybody in Detroit right now is thinking like, oh, there's so much opportunity. There's so many things to do. If only I had the money to do this, or if only I had the time and the effort to do this. And, I was just thinking of all these ideas that I've, driven around town or talked with people about. And, it was just this thing of like, wouldn't it be cool if we had this? These are all the things that I would do.
So let's go through a couple of them. A gay bar inside of a firehouse.
Yes, that is something that, I live like two blocks away from a firehouse that I'm not sure what the city is doing with it. Sometimes I see firefighters there, sometimes I don't. But, I thought of like how Anderson Cooper, he's openly gay and he lives in a firehouse. And it just seems like one of those things, there's only like three or four gay bars in the city of Detroit. There's so many empty firehouses. This seems like a no-brainer. You can have this atmosphere, these beautiful buildings, and why not?
And let's keep going through the list. A vegan Coney Island.
Okay, this is something that I personally wouldn't patronize. I'm totally against the idea of disrupting the Coney Island mythos and legacy and whatnot. But it's one of those things that, people are experimenting with so many different food styles, and what better thing to experiment with in Detroit than the Coney Island?
They just won't expect to see you there.
I'll try it once. I'll give it a chance.
Okay, let's go a little deeper into one of these, because I think this is a little telling. Number 7 on your list, an agency that teaches new Detroiters not to be offensive. Explain.
Okay, so it seems like, this is not to paint with a broad brush, but when you get into conversations with people, and these are usually young white people who move into the city of Detroit, let's just keep it honest. That's the population boom that we're seeing. But, because there's so many social differences and so many cultural differences, it seems like a lot of times people just don't know how to talk to a Black person or how to talk to a Latino person without sounding completely dense or out of touch. You know, it's not just a Detroit thing. We see it over and over and over again with these crazy BuzzFeed videos about, like, if I were, things white people say to Black people, mm-hmm. and, you know, if the situation were reversed and something like that. And I think here in Detroit, you know, there's already a lot of tension, and all this tension has built up for so long. And this was sort of a tongue-in-cheek type of thing. I'm not sure how you would profit off of such a thing, but maybe there does need to be a coalition or a board or something. I've seen this a lot where people will write on Facebook, like, somebody just moved in next door to me and they don't talk to anyone. You know, it's an all Black or all Hispanic block, and a white family or a white couple will move in and they'll invite their friends over and socialize within that circle, but they won't talk to any neighbors. They won't socialize. They just come in and out. And how does that make the neighbors around them feel? So, I mean, I think if we had something that sort of helped people, I'm not picturing everyone holding hands and singing Kumbaya or anything like that, but, you know, just simple things like talk to your neighbors, you know, or if you plan on opening a business, which is something that we've talked about a lot in different forms of media, don't dictate to the neighbors what's going to happen. Talk with the community about their concerns and whatnot.
So an agency that teaches new Detroiters not to be offensive, because as you write, do we really need another hand craft distillery?
Don't get me wrong, I love those, and not a knock on them, but, like, I feel like there's just a lot of opportunity to not just do another cocktail place where everything costs $20 a cocktail, I guess.
Aaron Foley's blog on Jalopnik is, here are some easy, rhymes with lass, ways to make money in Detroit. We put a link to the list on our website, michiganradio.org. Aaron, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Zoe.
And we always want to hear from you at Stateside. Do you have just, like, the best idea for making some easy money in Detroit or anywhere in the state? What is your big idea, your next business? Let us know. Tweet us. We're at Stateside Radio. You can find us on Facebook or find us on the web, michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. And while you're there, be sure to check out stories you may have missed. And that is Stateside for today. The program engineered by Bob Skahn. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I am Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.